Thank you very much, Clarissa, for that invitation, and thank you to the UNAA, I can't even say it's a bad start, the UNAA, and to Ian in particular for the invitation to come. And it's really, really very nice to be here. I was sitting on one of the wharves, thinking about what I was going to say, sitting in the sunshine, actually not doing very much work, because it was too nice when Clarissa rang me to, I think, make sure I actually had turned up, which is a good idea. It's very good to be here, and particularly this week. And the United Nations, I think actually, Elise actually told us pretty much why the United Nations is so important, despite all the derogatory things we just said, sometimes with good reason, but mostly without good reason in my experience. I'd just like to start from the first resolution passed by the United Nations General Assembly in January of 1946, when it first met in London, which was to establish a commission which would draw up a plan for the elimination of national armaments, the elimination of nuclear weapons, or of atomic weapons, as they called them then. 70 years ago. That's older than me, even, it's hard to believe, but it is a long time ago. And the point is that the reason why I want to talk about this today is that we've actually come around in a circle, because there is, before the United Nations General Assembly now, what is known as L41, a resolution introduced to the General Assembly a month ago by the Austrian delegation, together with some, I think, 32 or 34 other governments' delegations now, which is a resolution to be voted on this week or early next week. So we should hear the answer by Tuesday, because I don't actually think they take Cup Day in New York, towards establishing a legally binding, a legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons leading towards their total elimination. What the Austrians have proposed is that in 2017, the United Nations auspice 4 weeks of meetings towards the idea of establishing a global ban treaty. This obviously would be the beginning of a long and no doubt immensely difficult process. But this really is history in the making. This is the first time in those 70 years that there has been a concrete proposal for action in the United Nations towards a binding treaty instrument to ban nuclear weapons. I'll talk more about that in a little while. My own involvement with the United Nations is not on nuclear weapons directly. I was a serious young social theory insect in graduate school in New York in December 1975, when a man named David Scott, who some of you may know, who headed Community Aid abroad, arrived in New York to set up the office of the United Nations for the Democratic Republic of East Timor, for FRETELEC. And for the next year and a half or so, I and another Australian woman, Suzanne Roth, became the staff of the FRETELEC delegation there. Horton and I were both 25. There was some difference. He had talent and did extraordinary things, and of course went on to win the Nobel Prize. But it did give me a very clear practical insight into what the United Nations does and what it can do. And while, of course, the eventual liberation of East Timor from Indonesian invasion and occupation was very largely the work of, very clearly, the work of the East Timorese resistance at enormous cost, it was also critical that the United Nations never took East Timor off the list of the General Assembly and the Fourth Committee of non-self-governing territories. That was absolutely critical in East Timor getting to where it is today. And so that gives me a very clear and strong notion of why we should have it. I'd also like to start perhaps by going to something that some of you probably know very well. That very fine American poet, Maya Angelou, was invited to write a poem for the 50th anniversary of the United Nations some 20 years ago. It's a long poem, and I think it's an interesting one. I'll just quote one part of it because I want to come back at the end. She says, "We, unaccustomed to courage, exiles from delight, live coiled in shells of loneliness until love leaves its holy high temple and comes into our sight to liberate us into life." She goes on, "We, this people on a small and lonely planet, traveling through causal space, past aloof stars, across the way of indifferent suns, to a destination where all signs tell us it is possible and imperative that we discover a brave and startling truth. And when we come to it, to the day of peacemaking, when we release our fingers from fists of hostility and allow the pure air to cool our palms. We're going to need a lot of bravery, I think, for what we're talking about addressing and what people in New York are addressing now on nuclear weapons. The nuclear numbers, I'll just very quickly remind you of things that you probably know very well. During World War II, the totality of explosives dropped by all sides in that war can now be figured as the equivalent of 3 megatons, 3 million tons equivalent of TNT explosives. In all wars, the total explosives utilised amounts to 10 megatons, 10 million tons of TNT equivalent. The largest ever nuclear test explosion, which was a Soviet one in 1961, was 50 megatons, the equivalent of 50 million tons of TNT. At the peak of the mad 1970s and 80s, there were 70,000 nuclear weapons and huge megatonnage. Today, there are about 15,500 nuclear weapons, principally with the United States and Russia, and then after that with Britain, France, China, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and so on. I just want to do that because to remind you that the issue of nuclear weapons is still actually extraordinarily important. What's more important is to understand, to be very clear about the effects. And I think that the clearest statement of those effects is not an empirical one, but a conclusion that the Red Cross came to in 2013, and the president of the ICRC, Peter Mora, made an extraordinary statement which has had a very clear effect on world politics in ways I'll explain. And he said the ICRC has made an in-depth assessment of its own capacities and those of other agencies. We've concluded that an effective means of assisting a substantial portion of survivors in the event of a nuclear detonation, while adequately protecting those delivering assistance, is not currently available at national level, is not feasible at international level. It is highly unlikely that the immense investment required to develop such a capability will ever be made. And if made, it would remain likely insufficient. In other words, there is no medical response to any kind of nuclear war which is possible. It simply cannot be done. And what's more importantly, while we have shrunk the numbers from those extraordinary notions that gave rise to the phrase mega overkill in the 1970s and 80s, by the end of the Cold War, the numbers dropped, but they are still very high. We are spending still extraordinary amounts of money about this. Just in 1 year alone, the United States spends about $195 billion on nuclear weapons. The United States, Russia, China are modernising their nuclear weapons, particularly the United States and Russia. The United States 2 years ago, spent $44 billion modernising them. In the next 10 years, they are going to spend something like $570 billion modernising their nuclear arsenal. The Russians are committing similar amounts of money. And the United States, if it pursues its plans, and it will unless they are stopped, will spend about $1 trillion, that's a one with 12 noughts after it, $1 trillion maintaining, upgrading and modernising their nuclear force. The American military, maybe the Russian military too, I don't speak Russian, like to use homely little metaphors to describe their nuclear weapons. So one of their main bombs, just standard old drop from an aircraft gravity bomb, is a B-61, and there are about 10 or 11 different versions of this. That's being modernised at the moment, and it's being changed so it's not a dumb bomb that you drop off from an aircraft and just go down, but rather be fitted with tail fins which will enable it to glide and be guided from about 100 kilometres away, a so-called standoff weapon. That alone is going to be about $9.5 billion. And what's more important than that is the fact that this is actually increasing the likelihood that nuclear weapons will be used for one very simple reason. And that is that it can be the yield, the destructive capability of that weapon can be dialed up to the equivalent of 50,000 tonnes of TNT, or it can be dialed down to a mere 300 tonnes of TNT. I have no idea what that means in explosive capacity. No, I don't think anyone does. But what's very important is that at least one American Air Force general has pointed out what is obvious to every strategic planner, that by having that low yield of nuclear weapons, they can become more usable. You can actually think about using them. And of course, the consequence of that is that other people will then respond in the same way. In other words, the nuclear threshold of use is being lowered. You probably saw in the newspapers this morning in some places that the Russians have built a new intercontinental ballistic missile on which they are going to put so-called hypersonic gliders. These basically will be able to, they'll be cruise missiles effectively, they will be able to evade the American missile defense network. I won't go into the details of this, but this is a classic action, reaction, building up the arms race again in really very risky kinds of ways. So before I will talk about what is to be done and what is the United Nations doing about this, I'll just make one caveat. There are three very big reasons for doing something now, making it much more urgent even than in the past 20 years. At the end of the Cold War, we thought we survived. As Gareth Evans said, we survived by sheer dumb luck, but we survived. But there are three big reasons for urgency now. Firstly, sooner or later, in a nuclear-armed crowd, which we are in, and it's going to be a bigger crowd, we're going to run out of luck. The odds will go against us at some point. It just is inevitable, fact of having that weaponry. Secondly, you really don't need me to tell you that things are getting rather grim in global politics at the moment. I won't say anything about the United States, it's pretty obvious. But look at Russia, and particularly also look at China. In both cases, high levels of nationalism, high commitment to maintaining power there. We're yet to see this interacting properly, but it's getting pretty serious. And lastly, just to lay before you, think about the fact that unless nuclear weapons are abolished fairly soon, or at least we're on the path to abolishing nuclear weapons, we will be bringing nuclear weapons into a carbon-constrained world. A world where climate change is seriously impinging on the consciousness of people. It's not at the moment. But imagine as if in the United States, for example, you had the equivalent of three Hurricane Katrinas in one year. Then it will begin to be felt in the gut. And that's when the international politics of climate change will be very serious. And if we have nuclear weapons, they will also be involved at that point. I think you can say about nuclear weapons, the question of what is to be done, you can think of three at least plausible, arguable positions. I've got my opinion about all of them, obviously. And these are they're arguable, at least, debatable, morally and strategically. They're not completely insane. The first looks insane, I think, but it's probably not. I know people who I respect who hold the position of acceptance, of saying the balance of terror will keep holding. I think the odds are it won't, but there is a strong body that people who want to maintain. I have a good friend across the aisle, so to speak, a former Assistant Secretary of Defence in Australia, who very seriously maintains this position. But that deterrence can be maintained indefinitely. The second is a reformist position, through modifying deterrence with arms control, with getting the American Senate to pass the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, with establishing more nuclear weapon-free zones, reducing armaments slightly, we've got a better chance of survival deterrence. Okay, I can see the argument about that. I've been involved in some of those activities with Nautilus, particularly on a nuclear weapon-free zone in Northeast Asia. The third position, though, is against that reformist position, is simply abolition, prohibition and elimination. This is usually derided as ridiculous and utopian. In fact, there is a very interesting turn taking place, certainly in the United States, certainly among, for example, senior Republicans such as George Shultz, who was Reagan's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, war criminal indeed, but also very clear, the so-called Gang of Four saying, Nuclear weapons served their purposes for us, meaning them, in the Cold War. It's now time to recognise they do not and that they are dangerous. And people associated, for example, with Schultz, a quite remarkable arms controller named James Goody, now in his 80s, has put out very clear, very interestingly argued plans for how we might slowly reduce down to zero. And that's what he says. In the Cold War, thinking about nuclear war was the unthinkable that we had to do. Now, he argues, it's thinking about nuclear abolition. That's the unthinkable we need to think about very, very seriously. I think there are... I'm not here to talk about those issues per se, but that's the background against what I really want to talk about, the global ban treaty process. Non-nuclear weapon states, Austria, Mexico, Norway in particular, together with the International Committee of the Red Cross, together with global civil society organisations, in particular one began in Australia, ICAN, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, they basically worked together over the last 6 to 7 years with a very clear strategy in mind. Firstly, instead of every discussion about nuclear weapons being focused on the question of deterrence, how can you think of reducing nuclear weapons? Won't that leave us vulnerable to attack by the beastly people on the other side? Which is, at very best, nuclear deterrence. It's not a serious theory, it's just a hope. We think it might have worked, we can't prove it, but there's good reason to think it won't work forever. Instead of that, there was a clear strategy of saying, let us focus on what we have not focused on before. And that is the humanitarian effects of nuclear weapons. And there have been a remarkable series of intergovernmental conferences over the last 3 years, the first hosted by Norway, then by Mexico, and then by Austria. And the Norwegian conference, where there were more than 120 governments represented, to my astonishment, was the first time there had been an intergovernmental conference on the humanitarian effects of nuclear weapons. I mean, it boggles the mind, if you think about it, that we could have ignored that. And of course, one interesting thing about medical folks when they get involved is they tend to insist on evidence, and it's really important. Those three conferences were bitterly opposed by the nuclear weapon states, all nine of them. Within those conferences, positions hostile to the implication that this would lead you to want to move towards the abolition of nuclear weapons, that position was continually assaulted by allies of the nuclear weapon states, and particularly the NATO countries, Australia included. Their position was that to even talk about the humanitarian effects of nuclear weapons would distract from what they regarded as the serious process of practical disarmament and non-proliferation. Well, we've done well at that, haven't we? There is no serious disarmament work going on. There hasn't been any for a very long time. The humanitarian effects strategy was intended, and I think has come to work quite well, as at very least a supplementary zone of discussion for thinking about nuclear weapons, and to begin to challenge the presumption that you can only think about deterrence. That was the first part of the strategy, and it's worked, I think, remarkably well. A huge amount of evidence has been produced now, and in particular stressing the effects on the climate of even a so-called small nuclear exchange. The second part of the strategy was the call that was issued by the Austrian government at the end of the humanitarian effects conference this year, by the Austrian government, a pledge to call for, through the United Nations, negotiations towards a global ban treaty. This began in the United Nations in December of last year, where 139 governments voted in favour of taking the humanitarian effects issue into the United Nations consideration. The third part is what is happening right now in New York. It's happening this week or early next week. And these are the call the resolution of the Austrian government and 39 others to begin negotiations on a ban treaty in 2017 with a specified timetable. A legally binding instrument to prohibit nuclear weapons, leading to their total elimination. As I said before, it's very easy to say, but I think it's absolutely true, that this is a quite historic time. Whether that resolution passes or does not, we don't yet know. My guess is it is going to pass. It is being bitterly opposed by the United States and by Russia. China actually abstained in the December 2015 decision, resolution, which was interesting. It's also being opposed by Australia. There never has been any such resolution, and I think it's really very important, at the very minimum, to begin to hold the nuclear weapon states to account for their obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which of course promised. The five recognised nuclear states at that point promised to act to it at that stage, which was late 1960s, to begin a process of nuclear disarmament leading to complete disarmament. It has not happened, and needless to say, that erodes and corrodes the kind of core trust around nuclear governance in the world. The nuclear weapon states and their allies argued at the United Nations that this risks undermining, and they still are arguing today, the foundation of trust and compromise essential for the act for practical action. I'm not quite sure how that follows, frankly. If you want to argue for elimination, it doesn't mean that you therefore erode all trust immediately. I would have thought you might actually build some. There's a great deal to think here, but the basic strategy is that prohibition precedes elimination. Of course, passing a treaty, we're talking about having negotiations to pass a treaty, but passing a treaty, of course, does not end nuclear weapons. It doesn't abolish them themselves. It just begins that process with a particular character, and it's very definitely aimed at stigmatising nuclear weapons. Instead of countries like India and Pakistan showing great pride in their nuclear weapons possession, the idea here is to make it clear it's not a matter of pride, it's a matter of deep shame that we should be involved in any way with such repulsive, frankly, genocidal weapons. This is something which our Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, has opposed very strongly herself. She said, we should engage, not enrage. That's a very interesting phrase. Engage, sure, get involved in the argument and negotiate. We should not enrage? It sounds like a very, very ominous phrase to use, that if we dare to ask the nuclear weapon states that they honour their legal obligations, to say nothing of anything else, they will become enraged with us. And of course, you wouldn't want to enrage a nuclear weapons holder, would you? So it's a very strange idea. Australia has played, I think, a dishonourable and, I think, very counterproductive for Australian interests role in all of these negotiations. And this was revealed most clearly at the end of the Vienna conference, the conference in Geneva two months ago. The open-ended working group established by the General Assembly last year to prepare the way, basically, for the debate that we're having this week. And essentially, Australia worked as a leading agent, a spoiler agent, essentially pushing all the time for the recommendations from that open-ended working group to be watered down, moving away from the proposal for beginning negotiations on treaty to introducing what were called practical steps, which basically said, no, go away, go turn in the other direction. And what was particularly astonishing to diplomats, a number of whom I've spoken to directly, was that at the very last minute, after months of negotiations, and the Australians grinding together with the United States, with other NATO allies, particularly not the United States, they weren't there, grinding the proposal down, in the very last hour, literally, before the vote was to be taken, the Australian lead representative came racing into the hall with saying he had new instructions, and Australia was withdrawing its support for this consensus motion and was demanding a vote. What happened was the consensus motion, which was a very ground-down, weak motion, was immediately withdrawn. The original strong proposal was put to the meeting, and Australia lost that vote by something like 139-30, something like that. We lost doubly there. So I think this is very foolish. Our role as a spoiler derives from the fact that our White Defence White Paper since 1994, all of them say that in matters of nuclear threat, we rely on the protection offered by the United States, the assurance of extended nuclear deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. I'm not here to talk about the virtues of that or otherwise, although I frankly think it's both absurd, or it's absurd, it's obscene, and it's strategically reckless, and I'm happy to talk about that later on if you like. But more to the point, we are living with this contradiction. And I think it is unthinkable that if the vote in New York goes the right way today or Monday or Tuesday, and these negotiations begin seriously, it's very hard to imagine Australia not taking part, although the Foreign Minister is being very coy about whether we won. It was a humiliating and, I think, very bad, weakening, detrimental position. I'm going to finish now, really shorten this a bit, but just say this is actually about the United Nations. The proponents of this strategy, the Austrian, Norwegian, and the Austrian and Mexican governments, joined by countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Malaysia, most of the South Pacific countries, a huge number of countries in Africa, none of the NATO countries, but by all of our neighbours, in fact, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Pacific Islands, all voted very strongly for this proposal. I think that decision was taken with a view saying we could have gone outside the United Nations and had a more direct route to it, but the United Nations General Assembly is the only place where anything like global democracy actually prevails. It's a slightly odd version, you have to admit that, but it is important. And far too much attention is concentrated on the activities of the UN Security Council in particular, which is basically the least democratic part of the United Nations. To me, this is very important, beyond my support for what the resolution proposes, what I can, on which I'm on a board member, has been involved in. Because I think very seriously that there is the question of global democracy, whatever one might turn out to mean by that in practice, is deeply implicated, or the failure of it, the lack of it, in the continued presence of nuclear weapons in the world. There's certainly a strong argument, moral argument, to say even the threat of their use is a kind of terrorism, if you think about it. And I think some of you are probably old enough to remember what it felt like in 1962 and times like that, which I remember very well. I remember my parents' reaction, who were not at all radical people at that time. I think it's important because, for example, it is not just the countries who will go to war with each other which will be destroyed by nuclear weapons. There's a good chance that the whole neighbourhood will go. And more importantly than that, as the climate scientists have told us, for at least 10 years after a so-called moderate nuclear exchange, say between India and Pakistan, the climatic effects of what used to be called nuclear winter, now much better understood in these days of climate change modelling, will lead to famine on a global scale for about a decade. In other words, there is a human interest, apart from particular national interests and a broad concern that we really need to think about here. Sometimes people say, we know people in particular parts of who have been in government in Australia who have simply contempt for the United Nations. We know realists who are maybe interesting in other ways who just say, well, all this talking and trust building is very nice, but when you get down to it, what matters is power. I think the United Nations is an organisation which struggles against itself. People say, what is the UN doing about X and Y? The point is, the UN is only allowed to do what its member states, and particularly the powerful member states, are permitted to do, either by resolution or by funding or withdrawing the latter. So abolition calls at the United Nations seem to me to be extremely important place for this to happen. You could say that this, in some ways, some people will say this epitomises the UN's demonstration of futile optimism, futile utopianism. But if it works, it might be what we don't have at the moment, which is proof of fitness for purpose. That would be a United Nations that I think we would take immense pleasure in. I think win or lose in the next week, history has been changed by this coming, and I think we have a great deal to be grateful for the United Nations. Thank you very much.